everybody, and welcome to a brand new episode of the SmackDown Summary here on Inside the Ropes. My name is Kenny McIntosh, joined as always by Sondra when we talk about SmackDown. Hi, Sondra, how are you?
Hi, Kenny. Sorry, I'm fighting a yawn. It's early in the morning for me. But yeah, I'm doing pretty well. Nothing super interesting going on. It's like really icy outside and treacherous, and I'm glad I don't have to drive.
Well, I mean, first of all, there is a sad occasion today. I think you'll agree. We have to commemorate this episode to be in memory of a real rest in peace moment. Cien Almas, both those names will live in infamy in the past.
I refuse to let them go.
With the obsession of one word names. I love the idea that Vince just went, Ray, can we just drop Ray and call you Mysterio? No.
Okay, here's my thing with Andrade Almas' name, though, right?
Okay.
Like, okay, if you're going to shorten his name, because Andrade Cien Almas is a mouthful, I understand that maybe you want to shorten that so that people don't have to say three names. I mean, this is coming from me. I know it sounds rich, but like, you know, like Andrade Cien Almas is kind of a mouthful, whatever, you want to shorten it. Wouldn't it make a lot more sense to drop Andrade and just call him Cien Almas? Like, Cien works as a name. It's already his nickname. You know, like, why did they just call him Andrade? And now, like, in his song, right? Like, in his entrance song, it goes, El Ídolo Cien Almas. And, like, why? Now it doesn't even make any sense. So I have no idea why they decided to just go with the first name Andrade. None of this makes any sense, and it makes me insane, and I refuse to let the names go, and I'm going to call him Cien anyway.
I mean, I think that's to the shock of no one, but yes.
No.
That is accurate. I should also point out that I should also point out, sorry, I had a brain fart there, that we will, today, why can I not get words out today, Sondra?
Words are hard, it's okay.
Well, in truth, what it actually is as I was talking to you there, I was like, oh, I'll plug in my phone to charge it, right, because I'm going out with my mom later on, and then realised that because I have the new MacBook, and it is the devil, you cannot plug a USB into your laptop. And because some scummy member of the international press stole my charger on Saturday, I don't have a plug part to my charger. So I just plug it into, like, you know, laptops or whatever. And now we've started recording. The only way for me to charge my phone would be to take the cable out of the MacBook, because I got an updated cable, and put in the connector. And I'm not really willing to make that commitment. So that was why I had a slight silence in my voice. It's not interesting, folks. But it's the truth.
It's a whole situation going on. I mean, basically, all it proves is that Apple is a scam and having a MacBook Pro is not ideal.
What I will say to combat that is that I had a MacBook for 6 years, 6.5 years, and had no problems. You had a laptop that was fixed together with black tape.
Well, yeah.
So, really, because the whole reason I've got a MacBook is because they very, very, very rarely go slow. They very rarely crash. That's what I need. I don't really care about anything else. If there are African sweat children being taken advantage of, look, it's not what I'd prefer, but, you know, we all have our vices.
We all have our vices.
Well, no, because, you know, so I was saying this the other day. So you know how, like, vegans, right?
I was watching a clip.
You know Jen's a vegan.
I
saw a clip of, well, what actually happened was, we did a press morning on the Sunday morning, the day after TakeOver, and we did a bunch of cool interviews that are up on the YouTube channel with Pete Dunne and Zach Gibson and James Drake. We did two other ones, but because Ollie and I had a miscommunication of who had the equipment, it was all done on his phone, and Dave Mastiff, who's a quiet talker, and Tony Storm, who's a quiet talker, were both very low in volume, so we can't put them out. Anyway, so we put those interviews up, and then Ollie needed to go for a massive shit. And he was taking quite a while, so I ended up on my phone just browsing YouTube videos. And I saw a clip of Pete Dunne and Mustache Mountain on Good Morning Britain when they were announcing the Performance Centre. And they said that they're not actually vegan for ethical reasons, they're vegan for, like, training reasons or something. And about how it's,
okay,
like... Anyway, I was thinking about it, right? And I was thinking, you know, people talk about, you know, being vegan or not. In theory, I agree with veganism. I agree with it. You know, we should all not eat meat. But I'm not going vegan if everybody else still gets to eat meat. That's not happening. And then I thought about, if I became vegan, I'd then have to go down the full trap of, like, right, I need to be... I can't champion every cause. Do you know what I mean?
No, it's true.
And I don't know where I would draw the line. And then it's like, I can't watch this movie because the AP fondled somebody when he was 12. I can't keep up with it all. So I choose to instead... And given that my favorite wrestler is Hulk Hogan, you can understand this. I choose to just try and ignore all the bad stuff and enjoy what I can enjoy. But I do agree that Terry Bollea is a credit. I just like Hulk Hogan character. So, you know, swings and roundabouts.
Exactly.
And then today, I had a financial advisor come round to see me to financially advise me on how to get nearer to buying a house. And his advice was, as you would imagine, you need to get better at, you know, your stuff that you need to show being in order and not being in one big box.
Right.
So that's a task for me.
A box of receipts that, you know, just kind of is haphazardly thrown together is not necessarily ideal.
No, I mean, yeah, it's a whole thing. So, it's time to talk about SmackDown. There's a lot of stuff going on. There's a controversial segment that... Don't say anything, Sandra, don't give anything away about what you think about it. But there's a controversial segment, which I'm quite interested in, because I only watched SmackDown this afternoon, so I'd heard a lot about one segment before I saw it. So we'll see what we think of that. But we kick off the show in Birmingham, Alabama, with Becky Lynch arriving in an SUV. There were Becky chants in the arena. She sees the New Day in Heavy Machinery mixing up a protein shake with some raw eggs. Becky walks up to take a sip. The New Day are revolted that she's drinking it. She calls it a little weak and walks away.
It was not just a few eggs. It was like multiple eggs with shells and tuna and milk and all sorts of stuff that Otis Dozovich was putting in this milkshake. It looked absolutely vile.
I mean, all this tells me, Sandra, is you're not committed to protein.
I am committed to protein, but the eggshells are really what got me. I was like, I don't want to be drinking eggshells, right? And so for Becky, I loved this opening segment, and I love the Otis Dozovich stuff, and I know that's not a very popular opinion, but I think he is just such a bizarre human, and he makes me laugh. So, it was really, really cool to me to see Becky Lynch being treated like the biggest star on the show still, because she was, right? Like, you see her arriving to the arena, she's the main focus of the segment. And the New Day and Heavy Machinery are just kind of being strange backstage, as they are wont to do. And when Becky Lynch walked up to them, it was like the atmosphere changed and the man had arrived and she had a presence about her. She's such a badass, right? Like, she takes a sip of the milkshake and is like... Yeah, no, not gross enough for me. It's a little weak. I'm too good for this. And then I think, was it Kayla comes up to her and asks her something about Asuka. She's like, I'll answer it in the ring. And there's just an energy that follows Becky Lynch on the show right now. And I love it. And it's still every once in a while, I have to almost pinch myself and be like, a woman is the biggest star on the show and being treated like such a big deal. And this is awesome.
Yeah, you know, I love the presentation of her. I get why the opening segment might not be for some people, because it was quite silly, but I think the point of it, whether you thought the silly part was good or not, was that they're treating her like a main star. And I think, she got the full treatment, right? She gets to arrive in the car, you see her arrive, you see her walk through the back, you see her come out. When she's in the back, there's people chatting her name. And the thing is, like, I want to just say this one thing. You know, I am maybe not as critical on WWE as maybe some people would like me to be. But I'm definitely critical on Raw, but it makes me laugh that the people who are online were like, they're going to ruin Becky. They're going to ruin Becky. And she's now the biggest star on the show, but nobody talks about it because that would be positive reinforcement of things. So, you know,
I think that's why we're talking about it here.
Exactly, because we want to give it the due. You know, for every terrible Braun Strowman decision, there's Becky, you know, there's Becky Lynch stuff, and it might have taken them a while, but, you know, we talked about it here on the podcast, and I think it's true whether people think it or not. And I think maybe one day, if there's a member of the creative team who's there now that we could talk to in a couple of years, you know, we talked about them kind of hedging their bets after that first promo she did when she kind of spoke out against the fans. Mm-hmm. And she never did that again, and it felt like for about a month or two they were doing this whole, like, right, let's see where it goes, we'll be kind of in the middle and just go with it as to what direction it feels like it's going. And that's what they did, and it got bigger and bigger and bigger, and look where she is now. So while I think that the idea of her at SummerSlam turning heel was ridiculous because it was the biggest pop of the night, I do have to commend them for going with it, because as much as this is great, they could have continued to be stubborn. And what I got from this show and even from Raw last night is it's not like brand new era and everybody's different, but there are changes. There are a fair amount of changes in the product right now. You know, they've put Finn Balor in the title match, which is a new match. that people have wanted.
Yeah, which is awesome. Like, can we talk about that just a little
bit?
Yeah,
go for
because,
it, go for it. So it was supposed to be, I guess the backstory quickly before you talk about it is, that was supposed to be the match at Royal Rumble last year, and Vince didn't think that Finn was ready.
Mm-hmm.
So he puts the triple threat match together with Kane and Strowman. Fast forward a year. Now, apparently the plan, according to Dave Meltzer, was it's nothing to do with Strowman being ready. They decided to take Strowman out of the match and put Balor in it. So, and they gave him this big thing on Raw. So go ahead, talk about what you think about Finn being added to the match and how they dealt with him on Monday. Because it was the last time they treated Finn Balor like this was that, I don't know if you'd agree, that like that first Raw of the draft where he beat Roman in the main event.
Yeah, yep, absolutely. I do agree with that. I think I didn't watch all of Raw. I did actually check out some YouTube clips. You can tell when I'm getting a little bit more interested in what WWE is doing when I'm actually checking out YouTube clips from Raw and when I'm actually like having conversations with, you know, friends who don't necessarily watch WWE are starting to get in touch with me about it and be like, hey, I heard that this happened. I heard that this kind of thing is going on. And so like, while I didn't watch all of the show, it was, I was texting you when I was at work on Monday and you were telling me, you know, things are crazy and all this stuff is happening and, you know, like Braun Strowman is out of the match and he flipped a limo and all this kind of stuff. And I just find it really interesting that the plan was to take Braun Strowman out of the match for a while now and put Finn Balor in. I think it's awesome because Finn Balor looked like a really big star on Raw on Monday night. And that feels different. That feels refreshing. It feels like the company saw that Braun versus Brock was not going to be the most exciting match and no one really wanted to see it. I mean, I think you and I can agree. I mean, I've been a huge, big like Braun Strowman fan in the past, but from what it sounds like, and I haven't watched the show, but from what, you know, a lot of people have been telling me, he's just been on this constant like downward spiral of doom of booking lately, right? Like he's just not been a very effective character. Nothing he does makes a lot of sense. I mean, I like the idea of him flipping a limo again because I enjoy when Braun Strowman flips things. It's a good, you know, it's a good time. But they saw that Braun versus Brock was not a match that people really wanted to see. It wasn't exciting. It wasn't fresh. It wasn't new. And it was kind of a, you know, put them in a bad situation because if Braun Strowman just loses to Brock Lesnar again, then what even are we doing here? You know, like if you want Braun to retain any sort of star power or effectiveness, then you really shouldn't pin him, right? So they made the right call here, I think, changing the match up. And I think the way they did it was awesome. And I think it's really telling that Finn Balor got to be in a segment with Vince McMahon and John Cena and Drew McIntyre and Baron Corbin, bless him in his suit. And the fact that Finn Balor on television said to Vince McMahon, you've never believed in me, and that Vince McMahon on television was being used as an effective character to be like, no, I'm not so sure I believe in you. I mean, you're kind of small. You're kind of out here. It's Vince on television was saying the types of things that we all assume Vince McMahon has been saying, you know, behind closed doors, and bringing it out into the open like that feels organic and it feels like we're connected to it because it feels real to us, right? It's not like when, you know, you mentioned when Becky turned heel at SummerSlam and she was trying to rail against the fans in that one promo on that one night, that didn't feel authentic. It didn't feel like Becky Lynch would turn on the fans because the fans have always been behind Becky, right?
I have even a better example for you that you were there
sure.
for. They had Vince McMahon, they had Roman Reigns go backstage to Vince McMahon and say, Brock Lesnar's your boy.
Mm-hmm.
As a way to try and take you behind the curtain, but really it's the opposite because everybody thinks that Roman's his boy, so it didn't work. Whereas this plays off, if you're going to go backstage, at least let it be stuff that people actually think so you can then buy into it a little bit more.
Yeah, and I mean, we've said before about Vince McMahon being more of a recurring character on television again. Vince McMahon doesn't tend to be in segments with people he doesn't consider important or consider to be staples of the show, right? So for Finn Balor to be able to have that interaction with Vince McMahon on television, it felt like a huge deal because it really felt like, oh, so they really are presenting Finn as a thing. And then later on in the show, I didn't watch this part of it, but, you know, having Finn have to beat Jinder to even be in the Fatal 4-Way match at the end of the night, they were really getting behind Finn and building him as an underdog and really stacking the odds against him so that when he got his moment of triumph, it would feel even more glorious, right? Like at that point, when it's like you have to beat Jinder to get in the Fatal 4-Way, it's like Finn's winning this Fatal 4-Way. It seemed pretty obvious because that's the build, that's the whole story. And then for Finn Balor to pin John Cena in the main event of Raw and get his hand raised by John Cena, and for John Cena to even get on the microphone afterwards and talk about, you know, you've said people like Vince McMahon doesn't believe in you, but these people believe in you and I believe in you and all that kind of stuff. that's effective. That's John Cena being used to his most effectiveness, I think, right now, because he isn't someone who's going to be around a lot. He's not someone who's going to just like constantly be in WWE. So using him to build other talents and build other stars is exactly how John Cena should be used right now. And I thought it was perfect and lovely. And so I got really, really excited about the end of Raw, because it does feel like there's a little bit of change in the air. And you don't have to necessarily like revamp an entire show and change the entire format and all that kind of stuff for it to feel new and fresh. And so, I mean, there were some things on Raw that are, you know, definitely up for criticism, but I thought the treatment of Finn Balor on Raw was awesome. And it sort of indicates that maybe they're interested in building stars again. And I don't want to get my hopes up too high, because we've been burned before, but it
I'm with you, because I know that sometimes just people think I'm this Mr. Positive WWE and that's it. I mean, if you listen to me on podcasts, I'm not that positive. If I think something's quite bad, I'll say it.
I don't know who's telling you you're too positive. I don't know who's telling you you're too positive. I mean, you're more than willing to criticize certain things. It's just that you enjoy the show.
Well, I think the thing for me that I find frustrating, I'm going to give an example of somebody who deserves a little bit of credit here. Well, not a little bit. I say it like I'm the man to bestow credit. I don't mean it that way.
You're the John Cena to this person's Finn Balor.
He actually liked that comparison. So Sam Wallace, uh-huh. Who's on the Facebook community, he's very critical of WWE a fair amount at the time, right? Which is totally fine. He should be critical of a product if he wants to be. That's his call to watch it and critique, and he likes what he likes and doesn't like what he doesn't like. And he put this thing out on the Facebook community, which he didn't have to do, and he said, I think, you know, no matter what kind of how long I'm a wrestling fan or whether I enjoy it or I don't, the Royal Rumble's my favourite event and the card looks absolutely stacked, and I think, you know, props for that. Now, to me, if someone like Sam, who most of the things that I'll see him talk about with WWE are fairly critical most of the time, for him to say something like that says to me they are doing something right now that he is looking for. And the other thing is, you know, people say, well, you know, they said they would change the show, but there are still the same formulaic things, like the if you're going to face each other in a title match, you're going to be a tag team and stuff like that. But they promise new matches. So, yet AJ and Brian, I mean, if anybody's going to complain about that being a rematch, I mean, come on. I mean, it was like the best title. You can say you maybe wish someone else was in the match, but AJ and Brian is not a, you know, tired feud by any stretch.
No, it hasn't been done over and over and over and over and over. I think that maybe one more match is fine.
Yeah, I mean, they've only had two matches. No, they've had one pay-per-view match, then a couple of TV ones, but I think this is fine as a culmination point to them for Royal
and
Rumble.
It does feel like in their defense, AJ Styles does feel a little bit more rejuvenated right now.
And then
with this whole new AJ Styles thing, so it feels like there's at least a shift in dynamic, if not a shift in performers.
Exactly, and then you've got, you know, the Rumble. The rest of the card is all fresh matches. The Cruiserweight 4-way, I don't think those four guys have had a 4-way together yet. Shane and Miz have never teamed together before. Ronda and Sasha have never had a 1-on-1 match. Becky and Asuka have never had a 1-on-1 match. Balor and Lesnar have never had a 1-on-1 match. That's five fresh matches.
Balor Lesnar, honestly, is one of the only Brock Lesnar matches that I've wanted to see, because we got Brock Lesnar versus Daniel Bryan, right? Which was the big dream match that I wanted to see Lesnar have. Lesnar and Balor, it feels like there's an unfinished story there. And it's one of those matches I never thought we'd get, because it seemed like Finn Balor was just kind of resigned to be lower, upper mid-card guy, but never really going to be like the guy that we all kind of like thought he could be. And then now we're actually getting Balor versus Lesnar, and between, you know, Finn's appearance at TakeOver and then Monday Night Raw, it seems like they're really getting behind Finn Balor, which is awesome.
Yeah, and you know, I guess what I'm trying to say is I think they do deserve some credit for like putting some change. Even like, you know, on this show that we'll talk about, Andrade beating Rey Mysterio. I saw so many people last week going, oh, well, they've booked the rematch. That's Rey going to get his win back. Now he's beaten
because
twice.
That seemed to be what was going to happen, and it didn't happen.
Yeah,
because so they're actually like, and these changes, they feel fresh and they feel new. And it's, I mean, it's valid to criticize WWE when they do bad things. They do plenty of bad things, but it's also good to be willing to go with it when they do good things too.
Yeah, so it's you know, and hopefully what we do here is give you enough opinions that you like. You know, Sandra and I tend to watch most of the WWE stuff, or Finn watches everything because he's a maniac. Sandra will watch most of the WWE stuff. David and I will review other stuff. Went over to you. So there's enough people. Which, by the way, I should reveal this right now because he did say I could. Next week there will be a new original recipe episode.
Yay!
Where Robert's going to come back. We're going to talk some end of year stuff, some 2019 stuff. So that should be good. My final question about Raw for you before we move on to SmackDown is whether he wins or loses, don't bring that into account. Yes or no, should Balor be the demon?
Yes, he should be.
Can he be the demon if he loses?
That's trickier. But it doesn't make sense for him not to be the demon at this point, because Finn Balor brings the demon out in the biggest of circumstances and the biggest of matches. And a match with Brock Lesnar for the Universal title that Finn Balor never lost seems like a pretty damn fine reason to bring out the demon, right? So I think he should be.
I was thinking about this today. You know, there's. I mean, I don't expect Finn Balor to win the Universal title from Brock Lesnar. I don't expect it. I don't think it's the likely outcome. But, you know, this is one of the instances where, you know, we just saw Mankind win the WWF title on Retro Raw. This is one of those occasions where I would not mind a short title reign for Finn Balor. Because it's almost like if he won and you do, whether Lesnar gets it back or whatever, if you want to do Lesnar and Rollins for the title at WrestleMania, like, I just think that Finn Balor getting that belt for a week or a month or whatever it is could really add stuff to him. And, you know,
I think it could add to Finn, and it could add to the story overall, because I think Brock Lesnar being champion on Raw and being champion for so long and never being there, I think it's valid to criticize that, because it just feels like there is an absentee champion who, I don't know, like, when Brock Lesnar shows up, it doesn't have the same appeal as it used to. Like, I mean, I used to get really excited when Brock Lesnar would show up and have matches.
Do you
and
think
now
a lot of that's got to do with the fact that his opponents haven't been too interesting recently? Like, it's been like, after you saw the first Braun match, it was there was no desire to see it again.
Mm-hmm.
All the Roman matches, you know, the last time he had a match which was exciting, I guess, was probably the one with Samoa Joe. That ended up being the short one.
Yeah, that's true. Because, I mean, like, his match with Bryan was awesome, but it wasn't for the title. It was champion versus champion. So, there haven't really been any contenders that I feel could beat Brock Lesnar other than Braun Strowman. And they did their best to kind of run that into the ground. So, yeah, I mean, there haven't really been any title contenders that have been interesting. And I think that's one of the things about Finn Balor, too, is that he brings a different style of match. It's going to be more along the lines of, you know, what Bryan and Brock did, as opposed to, like, it seems kind of like when Brock just faces people that he's not interested in or other big dudes, it's not quite as compelling. But you can tell a really, really good story with Finn Balor and Brock Lesnar, because obviously Finn is going to be fighting from behind. So yeah, maybe the opponents are part of it, but I think it also just kind of feels like an old hat safe move to have the title on Brock. And because he's not there, it kind of feels like your top title on the show is never really a part of the show. It just feels removed from it. So that's, I think, kind of frustrating, because then, you know, what are we even doing here? Whereas on SmackDown, we have a WWE champion who's awesome and a women's champion who's awesome. And the title picture seems a little bit more complete, I guess.
Yeah, it's going to be. My hope for the Finn Balor, because Finn Balor is someone who everybody, you know, who watches WWE, if you were to say to somebody, who do you think in WWE should be doing a lot more than they are? It's Finn Balor. He's an example for a lot of things. NXT call-ups that should have done better, Finn Balor. And we'll never know what he was going to do had he not got injured at SummerSlam in 2016.
Right.
But my hope is just that whatever they do here, that he feels more like a guy. I don't want to see him against Baron and Jinder anymore. Like, there should be more for him. So my hope is just that he gets to do more and becomes a more interesting character. Finn Balor doesn't need to be the Universal Champion for me to care about him. He just needs to be put in environments that I care about. Whether it's facing Brock Lesnar, or whether it's, you know, an IC triple threat with Rollins and The Miz, or whatever it is that he does. That's what makes me care more. So I guess we'll see. Should we delve into SmackDown?
I think that we should.
Okay, so Becky is in the ring. She talks about, you know, she gets an opportunity to get the SmackDown Women's title back at the Royal Rumble, but she asks, where's the title now? You know, Asuka came in, had all that hype, but look what happened at last year's WrestleMania. Asuka entered with all the hype in the world, got in undefeated, and then lost to the women that Becky's been beating all around the world for 5 months. But then Asuka comes out to interrupt. The crowds are chatting for Becky. Asuka said that Becky was all hype. She was like a little bee, lots of buzzing but no sting. And after the Royal Rumble, she won't be in Charlotte's shadow. She will be in Asuka's. Which brings up the Iconics. We'll talk about the Iconics thing, a kind of different thing. But what did you make of the opening promo with Asuka and Becky?
I loved it. I loved the opening promo so much. I think Becky Lynch is a killer promo, not just in terms of her ability to speak eloquently, but also in terms of getting me interested in a match. She brought up some very valid points, right? That Asuka was undefeated and unbeatable and unstoppable going into WrestleMania, and she lost. And she hasn't really done a whole lot since then. That's true. That's another instance of what Becky's saying feels true and feels authentic, and I can connect with that and I can resonate with it. And Becky also pointing out that she beat Charlotte multiple times, right? And Charlotte's the one that beat Asuka, so Becky's on top of the world. That sort of logic does follow. And again, like, I mean, you just talk about the aura that Becky Lynch brings to it. And then Asuka coming out and facing Becky and, you know, saying that, you know, you're not going to be in Charlotte's shadow anymore. You're going to be in mine. And then just doing this maniacal laugh. Like, maniacal Asuka is my favorite Asuka. And I love the fact that she's so adorable and terrifying at the same time. And I love the fact that Asuka in this opening promo segment too was allowed to just like go off on Becky in Japanese. You know, she was yelling. You could tell she has fire and she has passion. She has fury behind her words. And I don't know what she's saying, but it doesn't even matter necessarily. It's something I've said I've wanted for them to let Asuka do a little bit more often, is just kind of like cut promos in Japanese, whether they're subtitled or not. It doesn't matter. You get the feeling and the emotion behind her words. And it makes me happy that, you know, commentary a little bit was a little like chuckly, like, oh, I have no idea what she's saying. You'd have to be fluent in Japanese to know what she's saying. But they didn't like mock her as though she was speaking a substandard language. They were just like, we don't know what she's saying, but you can tell that she's passionate about it. And she was treated seriously. Whereas I feel in years past, that doesn't necessarily happen with people who speak a language other than English. So there are positive steps being made here. So, yeah, I thought the dynamic between Becky and Asuka was great. Seeing them face off is great. I cannot wait for the Royal Rumble match, and this promo segment enhanced it for me.
Yeah, I agree. I think with I like Asuka doing Japanese in short spurts. I felt like post-match after the Becky and Peyton thing, I felt like she went a little bit too long. And I agree with you. I think when you do Japanese and you feel the authenticity, that's good. But I think you will get to a point where you lose people. Because mm-hmm. they don't know what you're saying. So I feel like they just about got there, but stopped it in time.
What I would like to see is if she's going to cut like pre-tape promo segments, I would love to see her do more of a long-form interview in Japanese and just have it subtitled, because why not?
Yeah, no, I'd be happy with that. But, you know, the thing is, you want the feel of a segment through the audience and the crowd. And mm-hmm. if they don't know what's being said, you maybe get 30 seconds out of them, but any longer they will struggle. But I really enjoyed the opening promo. Becky has all the confidence in the world. She's also kind of opening up some truths about Asuka, which is quite tough to hear if you're a fan of Asuka. Mm-hmm. And that's just going to... It's very intriguing. It's very intriguing to see what could happen. And I can see both scenarios. I can see Asuka retaining. I can see Becky winning. It's quite unpredictable, which is good.
Like, I think if we didn't have the idea of WrestleMania in our heads right now, like, I think if we were just watching this as a show and not like, but we need to have Becky and Ronda and probably now Charlotte in the main event of WrestleMania, then I would probably want Becky to win and beat Asuka. But there's that added element to it where it's like, what are they going to do? And I don't know how we're going to get to that WrestleMania main event. I'm not sure if they know how they're going to get to that WrestleMania main event, but that's the main event I want at WrestleMania. And you can tell that, like, it's very important to me because I don't like talking about WrestleMania before the Royal Rumble normally, but I'm just like, no, Becky Lynch needs to be in the main event of WrestleMania this year.
You were fucking talking about it in November, love. Calm down.
I know, because Becky Lynch is magic and very, very important. But yeah, and the truths about Asuka, though, I'm glad that they're bringing that kind of stuff up, right? Like, that adds intrigue to the story. And I'm glad that Asuka's not letting it phase her necessarily, but she is reacting and she's like, no, I'm Asuka again. Like, she finally feels like she's Asuka at full power.
Yeah, no, she does. I also loved when, you know, when the Iconics came out to interrupt and cut a fun promo, but then being women's tag champs, that Becky challenged one of them. Peyton Royce took the challenge and she wrestled her in street clothes, because mm-hmm. why would she have gear on if she was just coming out? Gear when you're just doing an interview is so annoying sometimes, but I mean, it's one of those wrestling tropes that you kind of just have to let go, but when they bring you out of it, it's quite clever.
It did feel like it added kind of an authenticity to it, right? Dimitri on Twitter got in touch with me and said that, and I agree with him, because it's kind of cool. It's just one of those little details. It doesn't bother me when people are in gear and cut promos because they're ready to wrestle or whatever, but it is kind of a cool added detail that Becky wrestled Peyton Royce in street clothes. And I was pleasantly surprised because it seemed like before this match that, you know, the Iconics interrupting Becky and Asuka, it just seemed like Becky and Asuka versus Peyton and Billy seemed to be the obvious match. And I was pleased that they didn't go that way. I liked that it was just Becky challenging one of the Iconics and then Asuka, you know, beating the other one.
Yeah. And when Becky beat Peyton Royce, that then got us into Asuka kind of screaming in Japanese, which meant she wanted a match with Billy Kay. So she just went and grabbed her and pulled her in. The referee just rang the bell. I'm not really sure whether, in official terms, you can have somebody be pulled into a ring against their will and the bell ring, but I'm willing to take it for what it is.
I mean, wrestling.
Exactly. But that's like, when you want to believe, you believe, right?
Mm-hmm. It's like, and when it works, it works, and this worked for me.
It's like that. It's like that. I'm about to give away at the ending of a movie. Oh well, fuck it. The Polar Express is all about the boy going away to the North Pole, and Santa gives him a bell, mm-hmm. and he can hear the bell ring, but nobody else can. Or you can hear the bell ring if you believe.
Yes, exactly.
And that's the wrestling test. If you pick up the bell and it rings, you believe, and if it doesn't, you don't. So, we got Asuka kind of beating Billy Kay in very quick succession. Asuka and Becky go face to face, so it's looking pretty good for Royal Rumble. I'm looking forward to seeing what they do, and there's quite a few potentials for stealing the show at Royal Rumble, so I'm curious to see who does it.
Yeah, for sure. There are a lot of options as to who could with all of the matches that are on the card. I really loved this as a storytelling mechanism too, with Asuka, you know, pulling Billy Kay into the ring and then very intentionally using an armbar on Billy Kay as she looked straight at Becky Lynch. And Becky's just like, oh, you motherfucker, you're using my move. That's not cool. That is uncalled for. And so, like, it really worked as a segment to me to build to Becky versus Asuka. What doesn't work for me about the opening segment, and I have to be critical, is the Iconics coming out and being fodder is fine. Like, the Iconics are great in that role, and I don't think that the Iconics necessarily need to be, like, top of the card main event level talent.
I'm glad you reside on Earth with us.
Yes, but my issue is that if you're building the women's tag team championships, right, which I'm excited that there are finally women's tag team championships. It's something that's necessary, but this is a company that also doesn't do tag team wrestling very well, and so I have my hesitations. And, like, one of my hesitations is that you have the Iconics who are like, we're going to be the first SmackDown women's tag team champions, and we're totally going to be in that match, and that's fine, but it kind of seems like most of the contenders for the tag team championships are people who have been constantly fed to bigger stars on the roster. Billy Kay and Peyton Royce are constantly losing to build other feuds, which, again, that's fine. That's a great role for them. But if I'm supposed to believe them as legitimate contenders to the tag team championships, then it's kind of frustrating. And I know that, you know, multiple people on Twitter were like, yeah, but, you know, a team will work better together than they would individually, so it makes sense. Like, they put them in individual matches here, which was smart. Like, it was smart to not have them just lose a tag match to Becky and Asuka. But I guess historically in WWE, we've seen that even established tag teams, even when tag teams are tag team champions, right, they'll still lose to a team of established stars because star power, and because WWE isn't that great at tag team wrestling a lot of the time. And so it's just, it highlights for me the need for more women on the roster. Like, you need more Dana Brooks, you need more Lanas, you need more, like, I mean, ideally people who can wrestle a little bit better than them, but you need more people to take these falls and to be used as fodder to build these stories, because it seems like a lot of the teams going into the Tag Team Championship Elimination Chamber have just been used as fodder for so long that division, like the tag team division, feels substandard. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it does make sense. And I think it was somebody said this to you on Twitter about, I think it was Lloyd Davis had said to you, you know, maybe the whole thing will be that they're better as a team than in singles. And I quite like that as an idea for, like, a lot of teams. Like, teams should be better when they're together as a team.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's how tag team wrestling should work 100%. It's just historically in WWE, we haven't seen that, right? Like, you see the Revival losing to, I don't know, Roman Reigns and Seth. Well, that's a bad example because Roman and Seth were tag team champions before. But you know what I mean? Like, AJ and Brian teaming together before their match could beat people because they're established stars and not, you know, just a lowly tag team or whatever. So I guess it's just, like, historically in WWE, we haven't seen them tell that story. But that's, I hope that that's the way they go.
We shall see. So then we got AJ Styles coming out and as Becky and Asuka are in the ring doing their segment, which was a fun kind of, you know, I just imagine you going, worlds collide, worlds collide.
Yay, fully formed worlds that aren't super segmented and separate.
So AG comes out and he ends up, we come back from break and he is at the concession.
And he wasn't scheduled to be there. Commentary's like, what is he doing here? AJ Styles is not supposed to be out here right now, which is why I like that he came out when Becky and Asuka were still in the ring, because that, like, if you're not scheduled to be out there, why would you wait for your allotted non-scheduled time?
Well, also what's kind of works about it as well is like, you could, if you're imagining in wrestling world that this is a real thing and AJ Styles is backstage waiting to come out after Becky Lynch's promo, he's like, right, mm-hmm. fine, I'll come out after a promo. Right, they're having a match. Okay, now there's another match. Oh, fuck it, I'm coming out now. I've been standing here for 20 minutes. So it worked. And so we come back from break and he's at the concession stand playing off what happened last week when Brian was there. Just kind of like, instead of the anti-consumerism promo, AJ Styles cuts the consumerism promo.
AJ Styles is like, we love consumerism and these hot dogs that have been sitting out on this table are really great and I'm sure you should definitely eat them and buy all of the merchandise.
Listen, AJ Styles would let me use a straw and Daniel Bryan wouldn't, so automatically I'm torn. You know, everybody, like, I love Daniel Bryan, right? I love him with all of my heart, but I know that fundamentally we would never get along. On like
no,
real world issues. Because like I'm too sloppy, I like a quarter pounder. He's never gonna love me.
He loves Nikki Bella, he might love you.
That is true. Oh. If I was Nikki Bella, my life's goal would be to get him to have a glass of wine with me. Anyway.
I think that is her life's goal.
So he basically cuts an opposite promo to what Brian did last week about the, you know, buy the t-shirts that you want, eat the hot dogs, drink the soda. And this crowd's exactly, you know, you said they weren't happy and healthy, but this crowd looked happy and healthy to me. They're exactly like the crowd in Phoenix that are going to want to watch me kick your ass. And then Brian emerges from the crowd in street clothes with a hood over his head, attacks AJ. AJ quickly turns it around and puts them through a snack table. And I guess the reason for why this worked for me is that hot dogs and soda can turn into Dean Ambrose with a cart. But instead, what they turned into was a brawl with AJ and Brian that I bought into, and like the snack table thing didn't even feel that silly to me because they were both vicious enough about it that it didn't feel funny. So it worked for me. Did it work for you?
I loved it. I mean, I saw plenty of people complaining, like, what, are they feuding over hot dogs now? Yes. Yes, they are feuding over hot dogs, and I want more of it. I really loved this. I thought it was great. AJ Styles came across as a little bit cheesy and a little bit like, you know, yay, consumerism. So it's weird because the alignments do feel a bit wrong when Daniel Bryan is like, hey, I really care about animals and the environment. And everyone's like, boo, we hate the earth. But for some reason, it just works. Like, they play their roles so well. And AJ Styles feels... I mean, I wouldn't say that I'm like done a complete 180 on AJ Styles, and I think he's the most dynamic and interesting performer on the roster.
You've done
but
a
he
solid
definitely
65.
Yeah, a solid 65. You know, I have turned a little bit, and it feels like he has a new direction and a new dynamic to him, and it feels like this is a story that he can kind of sink his teeth into. And I find this to be more compelling than Samoa Joe, like, stalking and threatening his family or whatever. I don't know, for some reason it's working for me, and I like brawls, and I like when promos are cut in unique environments too. This is not your standard in the ring and then I'm going to come out and attack you and brawl. No, this is in a concession stand, and it makes sense that AJ Styles would be in the concession stand because Daniel Bryan was last week, and of course it makes sense that Daniel Bryan would rail against consumerism. So, I don't know, it works for me, and it was fun, and it was different, and going through a table full of hot dogs and being covered in mustard is kind of a cool visual, and I loved it.
Yeah, I mean, this show was all about different environments. It really was.
It was.
In every sense of the word. Then we got, I'm going to come back to the Usos thing and talk about it all in one go, rather than just talking about a segment now, so we'll cover it all when it comes up later on. So we get an interview with Zelina Andrade. He said that Ray was his idol growing up, but last week he showed the times have changed, and Zelina said that after he beats Ray tonight, he will go on to win the Royal Rumble and the WWE Championship at WrestleMania. Good promo?
Yeah, good promo. Zelina and Andrade, they're great together.
So we get Samoa Joe about to make his entrance for a match, and he passes... So I should also mention, during the Becky and Asuka match, we'll cover all these now, actually. So during the Becky and Asuka match, we saw Lacey Evans sipping on a drink backstage, watching the match. Here we saw EC3 flexing to himself.
He's just standing in a mirror and doing finger guns at himself and like, yeah, no, I look good.
Do you think EC3's ever saw Zoolander? Like, I feel like he has a few times. And then later on when Rey Mysterio's coming...
Oh my gosh, they kept advertising Zoolander during SmackDown last night because I watched it on Sky and they were advertising the Sky Cinema Feel Good channel, and so it was like showing me clips from Zoolander and Pretty Woman and all these movies and Ferris Bueller's Day Off, and I was like, if I had this channel I would never switch it off, like it would be very dangerous, I would never do anything with my life ever again, I would just be watching these movies constantly.
But yeah, no, I'm with you. So, but then they did the thing when Rey Mysterio was walking and Nikki Cross is like, "I want to play Rey, I want to play."
Oh, give me Nikki Cross versus Rey Mysterio! Oh my gosh, book it, WWE. I want it so badly.
Yeah, exactly. So,
what do you think about the new recruits kind of being peppered through the backstage landscape on both Raw and SmackDown?
Well, so I don't think they did a great job on Raw, but I do think they did a great job on SmackDown. Like, I like the idea. Like, so the thing is, all these people are coming in, right? Like, God bless them, right? But Heavy Machinery are not coming in as the Road Warriors. Do you know what I mean? They're coming in from the ground up. Lacey Evans kind of similar. Nikki's just mental. And EC3, we've not really seen, you know, he's got some stuff to prove. So to me, I liked that they were all just kind of interspersed within the show, and all of the stuff that they did felt kind of in key with what all of them would do. So
it does.
I think that, because I didn't even see, and granted, I did skip through various bits of Raw, like I watched everything that was like in ring and promo stuff, but Lacey Evans and EC3 were in the background. I don't know if I just missed them or something. But
well, EC3, I think it was just like during a match when I think Dasha was interviewing the people that were lined up outside Vince's office or something. I didn't see the segment. I only saw the gif of EC3 just like looking at Dasha and raising his eyebrows and being like, yep, I'm here.
Yeah. So,
but it was quick,
like,
and it's subtle, right? Like, I love it. I think it's great. And I think it's a more effective way to kind of get these people in our consciousness than your standard, like, debut and have a match. And you can debut and have matches and beat some jobbers or, like, be put into a story or whatever. But I kind of like this as a new experiment. And it just, I don't know, it feels different again, which I guess is kind of the theme of the night. But it feels like I'm starting to understand who these people are. Like Lacey Evans standing there like an old-timey pinup girl with a cocktail in her hand, disdainfully watching, you know, Becky versus Peyton Royce and then Billie Kay versus Asuka. I get that Lacey Evans is unimpressed with them, but she feels like she could be a player because they have her watching, you know, this, right? Like she has her eye on the women's division. She has her eye on the women's division of Raw as well, I'm sure. Nikki Cross being brought in, you know, as like a crazy person. And she actually got to, you know, properly debut on Raw and have a match and look great. But, you know, EC3 flexing at himself in the mirror backstage and people being like, that's EC3. What is happening? I mean, EC3 is a weird dude who's super jacked and kind of awkward and also an adorable cat dad, and that's the EC3 that I love. So yeah, I want him to be weird and flex in a mirror. Otis Dozovich interrupting Paul Heyman and Alexa Bliss, I know a lot of people hated that segment. I fucking loved it. I thought it was great. It's that kind of like silly, ridiculous, that's right up my alley. And like, yeah, does he basically seem like he's animal from the Muppets going like pretty lady? Yes, it basically does, but he kind of is just a bizarre human and I want to see him do bizarre human things. Like he's basically like Baby Rhino if Baby Rhino were also a gnome, and just, you know, exaggerating the weirdness of Otis Dozovich is exactly how he should be used. So I don't know, I kind of love that they're being peppered throughout backstage and not all of them are being brought in, and you know, we're not being told that each of them is the biggest deal in the entire world. We're being told that they're characters in a world, that they belong there. And I think it's giving us a little bit more of a slower chance to get to know who they are, as opposed to, you know, the worst of sins, bringing in someone like Bobby Roode, being like, he's glorious. We swear he's glorious. He's really, really glorious. And that's all he ever becomes. I think this is more of a chance to get acquainted with the characters and kind of build them from the ground up.
Yeah, that's what it seems like to me. So hopefully it continues. We then got Samoa Joe make his entrance to face Mustafa Ali, but as Mustafa Ali gets in the ring and goes to the top of the ropes, Samoa Joe attacks him, sends him to the floor, hits him hard on the post with a great bump from Mustafa Ali. The ref tried to get Joe to leave, but then he runs back down and just is like punching him, giving him headbutts, throws him hard at the post again. looked to be leaving again, but then came back, and then was going to powerbomb Ali off the into the announce table, but just tossed him at the barricade instead and walked off. So, but this feels like, I don't know why, but Mustafa Ali and Samoa Joe fits much better for me as a feud than Joe and Jeff Hardy. What do you think?
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, I think it's because Joe and Jeff Hardy was based on the premise of like, hey, you do drugs and you drink, and that's not cool. And Jeff Hardy's like, haha, I did that indeed, but now I do not. And that was kind of the crux of the story. And I think I care about Mustafa Ali a lot more than I care about Jeff Hardy. Like, sorry, Jeff. I love your poetry, but you know, like Mustafa Ali is, you
also
know,
they're polar opposites, right?
They are polar opposites. And Mustafa Ali, you know, coming from being the heart of 205 Live and being kind of an example of like, yeah, someone who moved rosters and feels like a really big deal. It's not just a 205 Live guy coming in and being lost to obscurity. Like a lot of call-ups, I haven't seen that many 205 Live call-ups, but, you know, it seems like when people move rosters, it doesn't always work. But it seems like they've put Mustafa Ali in kind of the correct position for him. And Samoa Joe versus Mustafa Ali is like, you know, months ago, it's not a match that I thought we would ever get. And so now we're getting it, and it's awesome, and it's a thing that's happening. And when, you know, they started making their entrances for the match, I was like, this is a match we're actually going to get. And we didn't end up getting a match. We ended up getting more of an angle with Samoa Joe beating up Mustafa Ali. But it didn't really make me upset or anything, because it seems like it's leading to more of a program with them. And, like, Mustafa Ali just being this incredibly likable person who's always feels a little bit like an underdog and garners actual sympathy from a crowd, going against, you know, big brute Samoa Joe, who is an asshole and will mock someone about their substance abuse history and also go to someone's home and threaten their family and, you know, just be an absolute bastard. Samoa Joe's a dick. And so it's one of those situations where Samoa Joe being a dick to like AJ Styles or to Jeff Hardy, it still felt like Samoa Joe was the one carrying the feud and the one that I was most interested in. So you're kind of torn, right? Like, do you really want the stalker or the man who's mocking someone's substance abuse to win? I kind of did. But when it comes to Mustafa Ali, I'm so behind him and like, he has my heart. So I want Mustafa Ali to prevail. I want him to beat Samoa Joe. I want him to get retribution for these dastardly, dastardly acts that Joe is doing. And that's good wrestling storytelling. So I am all in on a feud between the two of them.
You know, yeah, I mean, I was thinking of this when you were talking there as well, but I had a conversation in the community with Sean Campbell the other day, and somebody was talking about like NXT call-ups and different things, and Velveteen Dream came up, and Sean was kind of worried that like Dream's going to get ruined when he goes to the main roster, and I was going to say, well, I think Velveteen Dream is probably one of the safest bets, because I think he's going to translate really well. And then Samoa Joe was one of the examples that Sean had brought up. Well, look what they did to Samoa Joe. And you know, to me, anyway, and I wish Samoa Joe was a world champion. I wish that they thought of him in a higher position than they do. But, like, and I made the comparison of AJ Styles and Samoa Joe, because when AJ Styles signed, they wanted him. They gave him a big, big contract to come and debut the Royal Rumble and be straight in the main event scene. Whereas with Samoa Joe, he was never meant to be in the main roster. He was signed for NXT. If people remember, he was initially signed and allowed to take other bookings, until they realised at 3% that that was a mental decision, so they stopped him being able to do it. So, yeah, maybe they don't see him as world champion right now, but he, like, while he's not world champion, he did get to spend most of the year in a feud with AJ Styles where he was cutting some of his best promos. So for me, like, the idea that Samoa Joe is a failure on the main roster is, I mean, I don't think he is. While I would like him to be positioned better, I don't think he's a failure. I think Nakamura is a failure on the main roster. I don't think
Joe is. Nakamura and Joe are in completely different stratospheres, right? Like, Samoa Joe is definitely not a failure. I think Samoa Joe is walking that line of being super ineffective. He is in danger of being a little too much like Bray Wyatt in that sense, where he talks a big game and he threatens people and he seems very big and intimidating and is an awesome character and an awesome performer, but then he loses and he keeps losing his big feuds. And so that's where, like, I want Mustafa Ali to prevail. I guess I would understand if Joe ends up prevailing in this feud, just because Samoa Joe needs to win a thing to remain effective or to feel like a credible threat to people. But I don't think it would necessarily hurt Mustafa Ali to lose a feud to Samoa Joe, as long as it's not just like Samoa Joe winning constantly and Mustafa Ali just kind of vanishing into obscurity. Like, I want my baby Mustafa Ali to be handled with kid gloves and treated like a star. So, but I mean, to call Samoa Joe a failure on the main roster, I think would be ludicrous. It's just, as an effective character, he does need to win a thing and he does need to not constantly be one-upped. And so, I mean, I guess, like, you know, who even won the feud with Jeff Hardy?
Samoa Joe.
Samoa Joe did, right? So yeah, that's it's not a good sign that I couldn't remember. That was just weeks ago, right? But I hated that story so much that I was just like, ugh, can it just be over? And I didn't want to pay attention to it. Whereas Samoa Joe versus Mustafa Ali, I think, is way more effective, has my attention. And, you know, yeah, Samoa Joe did win the feud with Jeff Hardy, so he feels a little bit more credible. And when he comes out, he still feels like a presence on the show. It's not like, I mean, Nakamura is just kind of background at this point and not doing a whole lot. And a lot of that's probably down to Nakamura, too.
Yeah. So, but I mean, Nakamura is just a, it's a whole conversation. A conversation we've had many times over the month, so feel free to listen to the archives. That takes us into, again, there's a Sonya and Mandy thing. I'm going to leave it all to the one thing. Rey Mysterio versus Andrade, or Andrade Cien Almas, whatever you want to call him. I did get a message on Twitter while we were recording, actually, from, where is it? Guido. I don't think this is his real name, but Guido, asking if we can discuss Rey's epic homage to his uncle, Ultimo Guerrero. And he's put a picture of the homage. So pretty cool.
Yeah, that is cool. I didn't realize that. I really liked Rey Mysterio's color scheme. Like, I didn't realize that it was an homage to Ultimo Guerrero, but I loved the color scheme with the blue and the purple and everything. I thought Rey looked great.
So they do this like 18 and a half minute match, and it's just like all over
Guido
the place.
Guido also wanted us to mention Vega scaling the ropes like a goddamn cat in heels because she is incredible.
I was going to leave that to the end, but yeah, sure. Let's just go. So they have this 18 minute match. It's back and forth. Near fall, and it's really great storytelling from the two of them. And at the end, you know, Rey hits his Canadian Destroyer, a close fall that popped the crowd, 619, but Andrade caught him. Rey pulls him out a crucifix bomb for a near fall. And then when Rey hits the 619, Zelina jumps the apron, and what was it he said again exactly?
She scaled the ropes like a goddamn cat in heels.
Like a modern day cat. She was like Michelle Pfeiffer in Batman Returns. God, my pop references are Vince McMahon level. And that caused Andrade to crotch him on the top of the rope, sorry, and then hit the Hammerlock DDP from the top rope and get the win. Andrade has beaten Rey Mysterio 2 weeks in a row. This match was the best match that I've seen in SmackDown in a while.
Oh yeah, for sure. This match was awesome. And actually, it's funny because when it first started, like the first like couple minutes of it, it started out a little bit slow, right? Because they had a lot of time to fill, and they built and they escalated and they told such a great story in the ring. The first few minutes, because I guess I wasn't expecting such a long epic match, I was like, I don't know, is this as good as I think it's going to be? Like, I was hesitant because you expect Rey Mysterio versus Andrade Cien Almas to be just like amazing, right? But they kind of took their time and they got me more into it and they got me more into it. And it's a bummer that it was interrupted by two ad breaks because I really wanted to see what was going on during the ad breaks. And because I was watching on Sky and not USA, I couldn't see like if they did picture in picture. And it was one of those moments where I was just really angry that the USA feed wasn't working. But this match was awesome. Like, it was pretty much everything you wanted it to be, but didn't want to hope for because, you know, like we've seen in the past, like AJ Styles and Shinsuke Nakamura, everyone was so excited about that match at WrestleMania and it was disappointing. And sometimes these types of matches in WWE, just because of the style and because of the production and whatnot, tend to be a little bit disappointing. And this was not. This was the opposite of that. This was like, if you don't normally watch the show or if you only check out clips and whatnot, like watch this match. It was incredible. And I thought the teamwork between Andrade Cien Almas and Zelina Vega was great. I like the fact that she got involved because she's a dastardly heel, right? Like, she should get involved and she should be helping her, you know, business partner, man, person to, you know, win. And I like that it kind of subverted expectations too, because everyone, you know, expects Rey Mysterio is a big name and he is a legend in this business. And so WWE, for the entire time that I've been watching wrestling, has focused more on, you know, putting over legends and trying to maintain their legend star power and their mystique and all that kind of stuff at the expense of current talent. And this match with Andrade pinning Rey Mysterio definitively after the Hammerlock DDT, it wasn't like a shenanigans maybe pin, like Rey Mysterio didn't kick out on three or anything like that, right? Like, Andrade Cien Almas won this match, and it feels like a little bit of a shift in the tide, right? With Finn Balor pinning John Cena on Raw, with Andrade pinning Rey Mysterio here, it feels like, oh, wait, maybe we should focus on our current roster. Maybe we should focus on the people who are here, who we can build and, you know, be useful for a little bit longer in future. I mean, I'm not saying that Rey Mysterio doesn't still look great. It's awesome that Rey Mysterio has gotten to come back in WWE and have matches, you know, like he is capable of doing, because Rey Mysterio's previous run in WWE was nothing but a big disappointment, right? Like
The end of it.
Yeah. And it was a bummer to see Rey Mysterio just kind of go out of WWE on a whimper. And so the fact that he's able to come back and have these kinds of matches and like be Rey Mysterio again, I think is great. It's great for us as fans because we get to watch him be a stellar performer. And it's great for Rey Mysterio to kind of hammer home the fact that like he isn't just this sad man with broken down knees who can barely move and should retire. Like, he's still Rey fucking Mysterio and he still rocks, but he is not like the current star, you know, like Andrade is the current star that they can build stuff around. And I mean, a few weeks ago we talked about how Andrade just didn't really feel like a thing, and you know, like Mustafa Ali beating Andrade just kind of felt like, okay, well, maybe he's just going to be fodder on the roster. No, he feels like an absolute player again. The past couple weeks have proven that he could be like, they can use him. They can use him effectively. He should be a thing. He should be challenging Rusev for the U.S. Championship, and they could have such a killer feud over it, right? Like, I don't know. He feels like a player. He feels like a star, and it feels like they're actually getting behind people on the current roster, and I think it's awesome.
For sure, I agree. It's good. It's fun, and excited to see where it goes. So up next on the show is we're going to talk about all these segments kind of tied into one. So we get Jimmy Uso and Jey Uso doing a photo shoot for Royal Rumble t-shirts, and they are modeling them when someone comes up with a gift, which there's a card that Jey reads out to Jimmy, and it's basically meant to be like it's from Naomi. At the end it says, "Love, Mandy," and it's a hotel room key. Jey asks him what he's going to do. He says he doesn't know.
A hotel room key and a rose, because it's very on the nose, because it's a rose from Mandy Rose, Kenny. She has a signature now.
Oh, bless her. So then later on,
which really kind of solidifies her as like creepy stalker woman, right? Because like this whole thing just comes across as so desperate and creepy. Like, she has been sending Jimmy Uso pictures. She is, you know, interrupting his match with lighting cues where he just looks like, why the fuck are the lights going out? I want to win my match. And now she's sending him a gift as though it's like, you know, secret admirer time, but it's not a secret because it's from Mandy. And she's just like, I want to be salacious and I want you so badly. And Jimmy clearly is just like, what the fuck? But at this point, when Jey Uso's like, I mean, what are you going to do about this? And Jimmy's like, I don't know. And it's like, what do you mean you don't know what you're going to do? You're going to ignore it and you're going to roll your eyes and you're going to be like, stop being crazy. Or like, I mean, I guess he could shut her down and just be like, do not contact me again. I will get a restraining order would be another way to go about that. Like, unwanted affection is not always super fun. But yeah, it made me laugh. And I was like, I had enough faith in SmackDown at this point that I was like, I don't think they're going to have Jimmy like tempted by Mandy Rose. But I was a little bit nervous because WWE.
Yeah, it was a ropey thread for the night because you wonder where it's going to go. We then see Sonya and Mandy talking, and Mandy basically says she's a way to break up the marriage, not because she wants Jimmy, because she hates Naomi. And that takes us to the hotel room.
Which does make me wonder, what did Naomi ever do to Mandy in the first place? Because Mandy started all of this, right?
She did.
I don't remember Naomi instigating anything. I mean, there was that one segment on Christmas where Naomi was like, don't come after my man, and threw a shoe at her. And that was the first time I'd really seen dissension between Mandy and Naomi, other than the fact that like they had a match announced a while back, and I can't remember why.
I think they had tweets as well.
Yeah, there were tweets involved. I'm trying to remember what the instigating incident was for Naomi and Mandy Rose. Like, I feel like maybe Naomi interrupted Mandy or something. Is that why? I'm really trying to remember, and I can't. But really, it's been Mandy instigating most of this whole situation. And Sonya here, Sonya Deville, voice of reason, is like, you gave him your hotel room key. Like, that's a little scandalous. Mandy's like, well, yeah, that's the point. I'm trying to break up their marriage because I can't stand Naomi. And you know what? I guess, like, some people are terrible, and so she's just like, I'm going to try and break up a marriage just to fuck with her, and Mandy Rose is basically just a terrible, terrible human. But also, doesn't it seem kind of dangerous to give someone your hotel room key?
I mean, Mandy Rose does not look like she was in any way scared. She was bringing it on. She, you know.
Well, I'm not even saying just like sexually. Like he's obviously like she's inviting him.
Oh, you mean
in
like in case the key got in the wrong person's hands?
Yes, like because she has the hotel room key and she gives it to some dude in a box. Like, what if this dude, like a delivery guy, was like, "Oh, I could go to her room and steal her things."
I hadn't thought of that, but yeah, I mean that's a valid point. She's careless.
That's just where my mind went. I don't tend to just like leave my hotel room keys in the hands of strangers.
You also don't tend to break up marriages.
I don't.
So then we get to the hotel room, and I'll explain the segment in case Andy's not watched it, then we can talk about it. So Mandy Rose is sitting in a black robe. Jimmy Uso comes in. It was a very nice hotel room, I've got to say. She's sitting on this chair. She's like, you know, come a bit closer to me. He's reluctant. She stands up. She takes off her robe to reveal lingerie, which the unintentional comedy is that her revealing herself to him was her wearing more clothes than her wrestling outfit.
Exactly. And like Mr. Saunder came into the room at this point too, and he's just like, what the fuck is happening? And I was like, well, Mandy Rose is trying to seduce Jimmy Uso because she hates Naomi or whatever. And he goes, if you're trying to seduce someone, why is she wearing anything underneath? And I was like, I don't know. I don't know at all. Like, if I were going to try and seduce a gentleman or a lady and, you know, wear like a sexy robe or whatever, I probably wouldn't have like a lot on underneath. If you're planning on having sex with someone, you're not going to want to be wearing clothing.
I mean, I'm with you. If I was going to break up a marriage, I'd just have my dick out.
Exactly, that's the way to do it.
Flailing around. Just anyway. So then Naomi's like, you know, trying to seduce him, it doesn't really work, and he's kinda like, we're not doing this. And then she basically is like, well, I don't want to have sex with you. And then a photographer runs in and takes photos of them standing clothed. Well, no, she's in her lingerie and he's in his full clothes. Camera photographer,
but like
in.
He had his hand on her arm or something, so it could possibly look like
okay
he was about to go for it, I think was the implication. I think that's what they were trying to get across here.
So then the photographer, now what was great about this is the hotel room for some reason has two doors. I do not know why. So the photographer runs in the left hand door, takes three photos and runs out the right hand door, which logistically I was just very interested in. And then
it was a bizarre setup for a room.
And then it kind of ends, I can't remember the exact verbiage, but it's basically like she's like, I hate Naomi and I would do anything to ruin her life. And he's like,
yeah, and she was like, and when these photos get out, you know, they're gonna, you know, it's gonna get to your wife and she's gonna leave you and it's gonna break up your marriage when these scandalous photos are released, you know, even though this is being broadcast on a television show with obviously another cameraman showing exactly what's going on. But sometimes you need to just like remove yourself from that sort of thing in these segments.
So she said she wanted to destroy Naomi's self-confidence. She'll never be as hot as Mandy and she knows it. And Jimmy's like, my wife? Then walks out. And then Naomi walks in, and I don't know what, I couldn't picture it, but basically Naomi flings something on the ground or off the wall that makes a noise.
I think she, like, takes her earrings out.
And then she just, like, goes for Mandy, and they have this brawl across the hotel room, and then Mandy...
It's kind of an awkward brawl,
it was an awkward
it?
Brawl.
Like...
I mean, I've got to say, Mandy got some fucking stiff shots in.
Mm-hmm.
To be fair. So, and then Mandy runs away in her lingerie. Jimmy Uso comes back in and is there to ask her if she's okay. And Naomi's like, I didn't get her, I wanted to get her. And that is the end of the segment. So, Sandra, take it away.
Okay. So, obviously, there's a lot going on here. I don't like this story, right? I don't. I think it's dumb. I think it's lazy. I think it's just kind of like... It's just kind of dumb for Mandy Rose to be like, I hate Naomi so much, I'm going to break up her marriage, right? And I'm not a big fan necessarily of like wrestlers' relationships defining them and all that kind of stuff that I normally say. But I will say that even though I think the segment was cheesy and crap and I don't really like the way the storyline exists, I think this was executed in a way that did not come across to me as like super misogynistic or super offensive, which is obviously always the fear with WWE, especially like This is the company that on Raw decided to have a segment where a guy walks in on Alexa Bliss changing into an outfit that she wasn't even wearing in the next segment, just so that you could be like, oh, ha ha ha, implied nudity, boobs, women have them. And what even was that segment, right? Like, it's not even that offensive to me. It's just real stupid. And I don't understand. And it doesn't really have a place on the show. The execution of this was as awkward as it could possibly be. Like, Mandy Rose is a very attractive woman for sure. And Jimmy Uso is just kind of like, what the fuck am I doing here? And as until Naomi appeared, I was like, she has to be there. Like, she just has to be there. They cannot be doing the thing where Jimmy Uso showed up at the hotel room just to say to Mandy Rose, I'm not going to do this, because like, why would you show up then? If you're not going to do anything about it, why would you like even go there and put yourself in a compromising position, right? It would make a lot more sense for him to just like throw the key in the trash and move on with his life. When Naomi did appear, and it turns out Naomi was there the whole time, I actually kind of preferred this in execution to like just having Naomi appear in a way. I don't know, like what I said on Twitter and what kind of like sums up my feelings about it is like, I don't like the story. I think it's kind of stupid, but at the core of it, the husband and wife, Jimmy Uso and Naomi, are communicating and talking to each other, and like, they're good, they're solid, and they're not coming across as like, oh, Jimmy's tempted by a pretty lady in a robe or something like that. It's like, no, the husband and wife trust each other. They're not cheating on each other. He has every confidence that like, yeah, Mandy Rose is the one instigating all of these things. I am uninterested, and I am so uninterested that I am going to tell my wife what is going on. Like, I mean, I've been in that situation where guys have come on to me and I've gone to Mr. Sandra and like, hey, just so you know, he just tried to get me to go into another room and fuck him, and Mr. Sandra was not pleased with this at this particular party, right? But that's like, that's kind of how it should go. You should be like, hey, someone's coming after me, I'm not into it, just making you aware of the situation. And then Jimmy Uso kind of like let Naomi handle her business. So in the end, it's not like I'm offended. It's not like I mean, I'm more offended as a fan of good storytelling, because I don't think that the storytelling is all that great or compelling, and it really just makes Mandy Rose look stupid. But in the end, I'm glad that, you know, love prevailed.
I'm glad that love prevailed. So I had heard about this. I said at the top of the podcast, I had heard that this was going to happen. Or all I heard was something happened with Mandy Rose. And Louise was in a group chat that I'm in, and she had said, you know, oh, this thing happened with Mandy Rose, and what are we doing here, whatever. So I was kind of set up to think that something was going to happen. And I was worried going throughout the show. I was like, oh, what is going to happen here? And then kind of at the end, my first feeling was kind of, is that it? That's the big fuss. But first of all, I agree with you. I think the Alexa Bliss thing and Raw was stupid. There was no purpose to it, right?
At least it's just edgy for the sake of edgy.
At least this one had a purpose.
Dumb.
So like, first of all, I hate the idea that like sometimes you have to. I feel like sometimes you have to defend the fact that you are a feminist before saying that you have an opinion on something, because sometimes it feels like if you don't like something, you are not being a feminist. Which is, look, I was raised by a single mum, and I have been around powerful, independent women all of my life, so, you know, that's the end of that. But for me, the reason this didn't really bother me, it's one of those, like, it's really crap, but I kind of enjoy it. Like, it's like a really bad soap opera, and it's acted pretty badly. But, like, the thing with Mandy Rose, for me, is that she has, since day one, been a sexualized character. That is what she's always been. She has porn music. She uses her body.
Her Vaseline filter.
Yeah, exactly. Now, if this segment had been Becky Lynch or Asuka or Charlotte, I would 100% agree and understand the outrage, as Poppy would say. But in this case, I'm just kind of like, but it's Mandy Rose. Like, this is her character. I mean, she is essentially playing true more to her character than most people do. Like, this
I mean, there are characters like Mandy Rose and Lana who are there to look beautiful. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that necessarily. Like, what would get me is if they were the only representation of women on the show, because there are definitely eras in WWE where, you know, all of the women are there to look pretty and be divas and wear bikinis and, you know, like, there is a place for a very beautiful woman being like, I am very beautiful, and that is what I bring. Like, we're watching Deborah on Retro Raw, her entire point is to like get her tits out to distract men, but she's kind of doing it on her own terms. So I don't think there's a problem with having a character like Mandy Rose and having her sexualized and having her, you know, be proud of the fact that she is gorgeous and has gotten her body into incredible shape. There's nothing wrong with that. It's just, if that were the only representation of women on the show, that would be a problem. But we also on this episode have Becky Lynch drinking Oda Stozovich's milkshake. We have Asuka being like crazy, maniacal, adorable, terrifying lady. We have, you know, Charlotte was not on this episode, but Charlotte is a very fully formed character in this world who is representative of a different type of woman. On Raw, you have Ronda Rousey. You have like Sasha Banks now coming at Ronda Rousey with her promo was really awesome. So this would have bothered me a lot more if it were 5 years ago and this were the woman's story on the show. But because it is a story featuring women and not representative of how WWE treats women as a whole, it actually makes it feel more complete in an odd way because different types of women are represented.
I almost feel like it's come so far that this is okay. Like, yeah. in the sense of like, and what I mean by that is that I think that you can do this kind of angle. I mean, if you were to talk about anything else that wasn't wrestling and you were to say that if you were to explain this story on a soap opera, nobody would bat an eyelid. It's a story on you. What I think is a better discussion to have is that, you know, maybe some men should be sexualized more. Maybe that should be something that should happen. Like, you know,
Bring Finn Balor's Instagram to Raw.
Exactly. Because to me, it's like that's more the issue. And yeah, like you say, Becky Lynch and Asuka are on this show. They're main eventers. Women main evented the last pay-per-view. Women had their own complete pay-per-view in 2018. They're probably going to main event WrestleMania this year. Like, so, you know, for the people who are, you know, this is taking women's wrestling a step back, I think it's more just, you know, Ben Williams put a point on Facebook and I thought it was kind of interesting. He was saying it was very jarring to see that contrasted with the other stuff. But I think that if you look at it again, it kind of shows how far it's come because, like I say, it's like, if you know, you've got Becky and Asuka, you've got Ronda and Sasha, you've got all these characters. Mandy Rose is not a character who is really a good worker. And she has always been sexualized since the beginning of this character that she's in. So it kind of fits within her character. And for me, as a fan, so go say a month ago, how often did I complain about Mandy Rose, right? Oh, Mandy and Sonya, I don't really care. I want to see Mandy Rose get beat up by Naomi now. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to see that 3 weeks ago. So to me, it's like, well, maybe the heel's doing her job. That, you know, and I think, you know, it doesn't help when there's rumors online where I think Dave Meltzer said that Vince really likes Mandy Rose and he wants her to get a push. But I'd much rather see Mandy Rose doing something like this, which hopefully this doesn't sound bad. I think she is playing to her strengths in a way of being a sort of sexualized character and getting more heat outside of the ring. Because that's,
no, that's true. And I mean, if they have Mandy Rose kind of take up that Eva Marie mantle, you know, the big redhead gaping hole in my heart. I still miss Eva Marie.
And Mandy Rose is already a better worker than Eva Marie, so.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And the thing is, I think Mandy Rose is talented. Like, she's not the best wrestler right now, but she's good. Like, she can definitely hold her own in matches. She's more than competent. And I think that given more time, she could be really good. Like, I mean, she should have fucking won Tough Enough. But, Sarah Lee from Michigan. But you know, like, Mandy Rose is actually, like, she's a very talented lady, and you know, she's a fitness model, and there's nothing wrong with that. I think that's part of the conversation that bothers me is when people are like, there shouldn't be any sexualization of women, or there shouldn't be, you know, beautiful women who are, you know, extolled for their looks and all that kind of thing. That's also a part of femininity. Like, it's the same thing we've talked about with Nikki Bella in the past, right? Where she's like, no, I look good. I know I look good. I'm going to show that off. I paid enough for my boobs. I'm going to show them, you know, like that kind of thing. And I don't think that's bad, because if a woman is doing that on her own terms and of her own volition, that's fine. What grosses me out is when it's like, you can just feel the creepy hand of Vince Russo being like, oh, bro, it's going to be so amazing, bro. Like, Sable's going to do this, and it just feels like it's so completely for like the male gaze and just for like 12-year-old boys to wank off to, right? But like, this feels like it's Mandy Rose as a character doing what Mandy Rose as a character, as a terrible, terrible human being, might actually do. This is her dastardly plot. Like, she's not very good at it. She's not very smart. She definitely underestimated Jimmy Uso, because she was acting like Jimmy Uso was just going to be some Neanderthal guy who, of course, was going to love her. Because in Mandy Rose's mind, she's so arrogant that why wouldn't any man jump at the opportunity to have sex with her? But I mean, I like the outcome of the story that Jimmy was like, no, I'm going to tell my wife about this right away and we're going to take care of business. And also, the thing that cracks me up the most about this segment is that Mandy Rose is especially stupid, because why would she think that Naomi is going to be scandalized by these still photos of something happening in a hotel room when this is the same program when not months ago we had evidence that hotel room footage can be doctored in the one night in Milwaukee thing that still just sticks in my craw, because where is Aiden English other than making delightful whiskey videos online?
Yeah, I mean, this was essentially like, this was what the night in Milwaukee should have been. Like, mm-hmm. something with it. And like, you brought up a good point. This was Mandy Rose sexualizing herself to get what she wanted, and that is part mm-hmm. of, like, there are women who are like that. Now, I think I think the underrepresentation of men is a problem, because yes. you know, have a guy be a sleazeball, you know, as well, or have something like that happen.
As long as he doesn't turn into Val Venus.
Of course. It'd be somebody had said something today and just wanted to tear my eyeballs out, and they were like, well, that's it. The Attitude Era's coming back. Next thing, we're going to have Samoans, you know, stink-facing lesbians. And I'm like, whoa, wait a minute. Like, let's all just take a breath.
Well, I understand on the surface why people are saying that. And I think especially people who don't watch the program or who are turned off by the idea of this type of storyline might see that as like, okay, this definitely does reek of 1998-1999 WWF in a lot of ways. Like, on the surface it does, but when you actually analyze it as a story, which is kind of what we're doing here, mm-hmm. in the Attitude Era, Jimmy Uso would have been tempted by Mandy Rose, right? Like, he probably would have left Naomi, or Naomi just would have been like a dumb jealous bitch or something like that, and like, you know, Mandy Rose she would have had a battery thrown at her. Like, I feel like they're treating it much better now than they would have in 1998-1999. Because right now in 1999, for instance, you know, make the Retro Raw comparison. I think we're the, you know, two good people to be having this discussion. I mean, we saw, you know, PMS debut, right? Like, we have Jackie and Terry are on the show. And at first, when they debuted as like women who had been wronged by men and they were going to kind of get retribution and get one up on them, I thought that was great. They were two of my favorite characters. And now they're basically just being reduced to dumb bitches who want to fuck with men for why. Like, we don't really know why they want to fuck with D'Lo Brown. Like, it just, none of it really makes any sense other than women be mean, bro. And I felt like this was more fleshed out. And again, I think the addition of Sonya Deville in here is interesting too, because Sonya didn't really support Mandy in what she was doing. So if this leads to some sort of interesting story with Sonya and Mandy as well, because we've been kind of teasing dissension between them, and like, is their friendship being called into question? Does Sonya not agree with what Mandy is doing? Could Sonya end up aligning with Naomi? Like, I don't know. I think there are interesting ways to go from it. Like I said, I sound like I'm defending the story a whole bunch. I think it's trash, but it was trash executed in the best possible way for me.
Well, also,
I guess
I feel like, you know, I mean, as someone who watched the Attitude Era, and I've watched WWE most, I mean, I think I missed like 2 years all in, but like, I've watched since 1990, whatever, right? And this did not, what I actually enjoyed about it was, like, you know, the idea that so many different things happened in this show. Do you know what I mean? You had a brawl, a concession stand, a sleazy moment in a hotel room. There was all these different things going on, and I felt it helped the pace of the show. But, you know, they've got
That's something that did feel a little bit more Attitude Era to me, was the frenetic pace of it and how the segments collided into one another, and there was a storyline thread throughout the show. That's the kind of stuff that people praise the Attitude Era for, and I praise the Attitude Era for too. And then Val Venus or a Godwin will show up, and I just, because
I was thinking about sometimes, you know, I'll give a Retro Raw thumbs in the middle or whatever, but I tend to give SmackDown a thumbs up most of the time. And I was trying to think about why that is, because I definitely had more fun back then watching wrestling, because I trusted that the characters were all going to be, like, if somebody, you know, if somebody was in a world title match, they were not going to be in the pre-show of the pay-per-view the next month. That would never happen. Somebody was always kept in the mix or put somewhere else. But I think what maybe makes nowadays have more of thumbs up is that the wrestling quality is better. So mm-hmm. even if but I think you're right. I think the idea of having these different paced shows where you're in different places, because that's one of the things, like, a lot of times right now they don't do that much story with people. And, you know, it's evidenced by the fact that how many times we've seen The Bar and the Usos have a match, or the Usos and the New Day or whatever. And 99% of it's just them having matches.
And they're always good, but it's just, it's kind of the same story stuck on repeat. And it's interesting too to compare this. I mean, everyone's making Attitude Era comparisons, but someone brought up on Twitter, like, remember when they did this essentially like the same angle with Lana and Enzo Amore? And it was wrong in of the ways. Because Enzo Amore like went to Lana's hotel room and was like, basically, because I mean, Enzo Amore was like,
use her for sex, right?
He was going to use her for sex, and he was basically like perving on Lana for weeks beforehand. And he was supposed to be the babyface somehow, which I just still blows my mind. But he basically like, he goes to Lana's hotel room, and then he was like, I don't know, maybe I shouldn't do this. And then like Lana basically like rips his pants down and beats him up and like leaves him laying. And he was supposed to be the sympathetic babyface here, but it's like, you've been the one perving on her the entire time. I don't really understand. I mean, there were a lot of like weird rapey like implications with that segment too, the way Lana was treating Enzo. And it was just basically problematic in all of the ways. The alignments were wrong. I didn't feel sympathy for Enzo because he was the one advancing things. He was the one instigating the whole situation. In this storyline, Mandy Rose has been the dastardly heel. She has instigated everything. Jimmy Uso has not seemed fazed by it. He hasn't seemed stupid. He hasn't seemed like he's going to stray, which is good. Naomi came across as a little bit possessive and jealous at first, but then when Mandy kind of upped the ante, it was like, okay, no, I get it. Like, you have a right to be upset. Like, Mandy Rose is being very out of line here, obviously. But then, I mean, where Mandy really underestimated Jimmy and Naomi was she thought that, you know, she, the pretty white girl, of course, like, why would anyone say no to her? And they're just like, no, bitch, step off. Like, go away. You are not everything that you think you are. And my wife is more secure in her, like, Naomi is more secure in herself than to believe that Jimmy Uso is going to stray from her. Like, she, because he was honest with her and she was honest with him. Like I said, love prevailed.
So yeah, I guess we'll see where the story goes. I'm hopeful for it. I mean, put it this way, a Naomi and Mandy Rose match, because I think it was Paige had said it was going to happen like 3 weeks ago, and it didn't happen. And at that point, yeah, I'm just talking for me. At that point, I was like, well, who cares what happens? Like, who gives a shit? Whereas now, I'm like, oh, I kind of want to see Naomi. The moment I knew that I was into it, for whatever strange reason, was when Naomi chucked her jewelry against the wall. I was like, oh, I hope she fucking nails her.
Yeah, and that was a criticism I had, was I thought the brawl wasn't violent enough, and like I don't understand why Jimmy left the room for so long to like let Naomi get beat up, because that seemed really strange. Like, why wouldn't he help Naomi? Why wouldn't he like get Mandy Rose off of Naomi? Because Naomi was kind of left laying for a little bit. But I mean, it kind of does make me want to see them have a match. I don't think the match is going to be great or anything like that, because neither of them are really great wrestlers. But it is a testament to telling a story makes things more compelling. Even if the story's kind of trash and I wish it were better, at least they're trying stuff. That's another praise I'll give them.
Yeah, you need to throw shit against the wall and see what happens. So the main event segment of the show, we have The Miz giving his bestie birthday celebration to Shane McMahon. So he comes out, he introduces Shane. He's got a bunch of gifts and happy birthday sign in the ring. He brings out Shane McMahon. He has got Shane a gift, which, you know, they've also got the World Cup trophy there. He had Shane open a gift, and it's some brand new Jordans, some Nike trainers. Shane seemed genuinely thrilled at these gifts.
Because Miz knows his partner and got him a gift that would be important to him. Shane loves his shoes. I loved this segment, by the way.
Now, who would have thought that in the main event of SmackDown, a segment revolving around Shane McMahon and, like, a celebration for him, including a career retrospective highlight video, would be anything Sondra would want a part of?
And I loved it. I absolutely loved all of it. Like, The Miz was so sweet giving Shane the retrospective video. It basically just highlighted that Shane McMahon jumps off things repeatedly, and that's what he does. But the highlight video was just so nice, and it was from the heart. And Miz is such a genuine person right now, which is kind of an understated thing that I don't see a lot of people talking about, is that Miz is very solidified as a babyface at this point, and it was organic. He didn't change characters necessarily. He just, like, he found friendship and love.
He found friendship and love.
And he managed to bring Shane McMahon around to the side of friendship and love as well, because Shane McMahon was so dismissive of The Miz, but we've seen now that The Miz, like, I mean, it could very well end in The Miz turning on Shane McMahon, who knows, but it feels genuine right now, and it feels like they're actually kind of pals and there for each other. And you know how much I love friendship in wrestling.
it's a rarity that it comes along, but yeah, I understand why you like it. So Miz gives him these Jordans, shows the highlight video. Shane seems pretty touched by it. And then Shane said, you know, I liked that you told me all about your dad and the relationship that you had. And then he said, you know, I want to open up to you and tell you that ever since I was a kid, I really wanted to be a tag team champion. My first partner was supposed to be Andre the Giant. But I'll be proud and honored to be your partner at the Royal Rumble. Miz then starts saying happy birthday to the crowd, but they're interrupted by the bar. Sheamus called him a joke, says, you know, so odd that Vince McMahon didn't get an invite. And Cesaro said, you know, they did invite him, but he just doesn't give a crap about Shane or his birthday. Shane then called out Sheamus for bro-kicking the Miz last week. So, you know, you think you must be a real tough guy. But he should test himself against the Miz tonight. And Miz is in his suit saying, like, I can't do this. Like, I'm in a suit. And Shane gives Miz a pep talk.
It was lovely. I mean, in a way, it's almost Shane being a little bit of a dick, right? Because he's not like, I'm going to fight you. But I like that, though. I like that he's like, no, I have confidence in my partner. I'm going to put you in a match against my partner, and my partner can show you how great and tough he is, right? Like, it could be either way in Shane's head, like, depending on his motivation. It could be him still fucking with The Miz a little bit. But it seems like Shane is starting to believe in The Miz. And that's what I'm going to choose to believe, because I want to believe in the, like, the power of love and friendship. So, and I thought that the pep talk was lovely, though, too, where Shane was like, no, you're The Miz. You're awesome. You're must see. Like, it doesn't matter if you're wrestling in a suit or if you're wrestling in gear. It's, you know, you're The Miz and you can still do great things. And then, you know, The Miz was sort of fortified by this. And he was like, no, you're right. I can wrestle in a suit. And then, you know, and it's funny, too, because the trope of Miz trying to present gear to Shane McMahon for weeks in a row now. You know, I think they even said at one point in the segment, like, whether we wear the red leather or the black leather, or the white leather at, you know, the Royal Rumble, we're going to be a team and it's going to be awesome. And so, you know, the references to Mrs. Gear, again, I kind of like that as the underlying trope of their friendship. And, you know, and then Miz actually wrestling in gear. We talked about it with Becky Lynch earlier. I like the fact that Miz was put in a match and wrestled in a suit, because it lended some authenticity to the segment. It was like, oh, we didn't expect the bar to just come out. And the bar were in gear, so they were obviously expecting something to happen. But it still, it felt a little bit more organic and cohesive.
And the Miz and Shane thing is working on a variety of levels. And it's like you said, I mean, the thing about Shane's not lording over the show, he's part of the show. It works, and Miz is likable for the first time in ages, so...
And this, like, this is so different to me than Miz's first horrible, horrible babyface run with, like, Ric Flair, right?
Oh, you mean when he won the Intercontinental Championship and Dave Meltzer said it was God crying when it rained?
Yes, exactly. That was the time. Because when Miz was a babyface before, they tried to make the Miz into a WWE babyface. And they tried to give him a legend, and they tried to give him the figure four, which he cannot do very well. And none of it felt like it fit. Like, that, the Miz as a smiling babyface does not work. The Miz as a guy that everyone kind of got behind because he was so charismatic, and a guy who talks about how, you know, his father didn't love him and he wants to be co-besties in the world with another man based on, you know, disappointing their fathers and all of that kind of thing. Like, this feels organic, and he still feels like the Miz. He doesn't feel like the Miz shoved into a WWE babyface box. He just feels like a dude that I really, really like.
So we get the Miz and Sheamus match. It was okay. It wasn't really that great, but it was fine. Miz is wrestling in his suit trousers, but in the end, of course, Cesaro jumps on the apron to distract Miz. Shane then jumps on the apron and tosses Cesaro through a cake table because he is Superman, and and this allows Miz to roll up Sheamus for the win. And Tom Phillips, Tom or Cody said, I think they might have a chance. I thought it was a really good line, because it was like, you know, not the idea that Miz or Shane couldn't win a match, but it's the idea that, well, them together, they've never been a team before, but they showed some unity.
Well, it's what we were talking about, tag team cohesion too, right? Like, we were talking about that with the Iconics, and tag team cohesion here is kind of called into question, right? Like, this is a match that I should want the bar to win, because they've been a team for a long time. They're established. They, you know, I mean, they ended the Usos' long, long tag team reign. Like, the bar, great. But I think because Miz and Shane have this newfound friendship, and they have this newfound, like, partnership where they're actually supporting each other, it feels like they're fighting from underneath. And I actually want Miz and Shane McMahon to be the tag team champions at the Royal Rumble. What is happening in the year of our Lord 2019, Kenny?
It is a strange, strange world. Post-match, Shane runs in to help Miz get off Sheamus, and then they team up to beat up Sheamus, skull-crushing finale. And then Shane hits a coast-to-coast as Miz puts a
birthday cake.
Barely.
I mean, Miz puts the birthday cake on Sheamus's chest. Shane, like, I mean, bless him, but he barely brushes Sheamus's chest and sort of like kicks the bottom of the cake. So it was kind of funny. It's almost like, you know, that scene in Ed Wood where he has to fight the octopus, but he has to make it look like the octopus is attacking him, and he has to roll around in the river, right? That's kind of what it reminded me of with Sheamus and the birthday cake, because you could see that he's just like, no, I need to roll around in this birthday cake because it's supposed to be on me, but like none of it actually hit me.
Well, I also feel like when Shane McMahon was younger and he was like, I need to come up with a move that people will respect me for, and it's like, now you're 47.
Yeah. And I'm not saying, I mean, Shane McMahon being able to jump that far is still a feat for sure, but it looked like he almost kind of hurt himself doing it, and I was like, maybe just be careful. Like, I want you to make it to the Royal Rumble. I want you to be able to have this match.
How much did you enjoy Miz smearing cake on Shane's face as a wee jab?
It was so cute. I love it. I love everything about this.
And they hold up their World Cup trophy to end the show.
Because the trophy is their baby and they're the co-besties in the world. Mm-hmm. It's just... I don't know what's... This is a testament to good storytelling, though, right? Like, I hated Shane McMahon. I hated when he would show up. I hated dickhead Shane McMahon, who wouldn't give Heath Slater a job. All of those things are still there. But right now, Shane McMahon is being a very effective character on SmackDown Live. And when, you know, when things that are bad become good, I think that they are worthy of praise.
Yeah. I thought it was a thumbs-up show. I thought they did some really good stuff on Raw this week to kind of advance things, including getting Sasha some time with Ronda, and I think on SmackDown they did a lot of good stuff as well. So, thumbs up show for me.
Yeah, it's a big old thumbs up show for me. I was nervous about the Mandy Rose stuff, and the more I think about it, the more I almost kind of like how it was executed, even if the story is trash. And there's a lot of good stuff. Becky Lynch is still ruling the world as well. She should. SmackDown's a great show.
Which again is key for me. I would have been annoyed or sort of perturbed by the Mandy Rose thing if the person in that segment, in that story, was not the sexualized character who's not a very good wrestler. It would have bothered me if it was somebody like Becky or Charlotte. Then I would have been like, fuck this.
Yeah, for sure. But, I mean, the characters are feeling fully formed. I think SmackDown's legitimately a very good wrestling show. I mean, there are issues with it sometimes, but right now it's on track to do some good things. And also Otis Dozovich is in our lives on the main roster, and maybe he'll work better on the main roster than he did in NXT. We'll see.
Oh, last night Vince sent a tweet out saying, to the greatest son a father could ever have, happy birthday Shane McMahon. Oh,
didn't one of the bar respond like you didn't even come to his birthday party?
They did. There was also a news note that we should just bring up quickly. The Revival and Mike and Maria Kanellis have all asked for their releases.
Oh, is that true?
Apparently so. I mean,
I cannot blame them.
I mean, Mike and Maria especially.
Yeah, seriously. I mean, they have such a belter of a theme tune that we never get to hear.
I know. And now 205 Live's back to be on after SmackDown. Well done.
Which I didn't even know until I saw people tweeting about it last night. And I could have watched it, but I didn't even... Like, did they say that during SmackDown? Because I was doing like some other things while I was watching the show, but I thought I was paying enough attention.
No, I read it on The Observer that as of this week it's back to the... Why are they putting it back to after SmackDown?
I don't know. It doesn't make any sense. The Wednesday block of television was great. Like, having 205 Live and NXT on the same night, like, I was more like... I mean, like, I can still watch it on Wednesdays if I want to, but it's... I mean, from all accounts, the crowd was just kind of dead and it wasn't the greatest show. And like, there's some good stuff going on. I'm definitely going to tune in because I want to see Humberto Carrillo versus Buddy Murphy, because like, I just really like Humberto Carrillo like a lot. But
spoilers.
What?
I'm kidding. It was an open
it's
challenge.
It's already happened. It's already aired. Oh yeah, it was an open challenge. But whatever. See, like,
check me and my cruiserweight
knowledge.
If
anyone's getting mad about 205 Live spoilers a day after it's aired.
What was I going to say? And also on NXT UK, apparently that was on tonight, they have that match I was telling you about with Marcel Bartel and Fabian Aichner.
Yeah, and I'm going to get back to watching that, because actually when you texted me to record, I was in the middle of watching Ginny versus Isla Dawn and completely had lost track of what time it was because I was watching Jenny versus Isla Dawn, so that's what I plan to get back to right after this.
There you go. Well, thank you for listening, everybody. We appreciate all your support. Sandra, give us some plugs, please.
All right. You can find me on Twitter at SandraRuthRW. Find Kenny on Twitter at KennyMC1985. Follow Inside the Ropes at Inside_the Ropes. Go to YouTube.com/InsideTheRopes for tons of interview content. Bunch of new stuff coming up that has just come out from the NXT TakeOver UK press junket conference thing that Kenny did. Lots of really cool interviews with Triple H, Charlotte Flair, Finn Balor. I'm bringing it back. Go to patreon.com/InsideTheRopes for tons of bonus content. We cover all the pay-per-views over there, retro pay-per-views, current pay-per-views, PowerSlam Overrun, PowerSlam podcast goes up a day early on Patreon, tons of bonus content, and that's kind of what allows us to do what we do here. So we thank you, everyone, for your support. Leading into Royal Rumble, we're going to have tons more content. For Retro Raw, we're actually coming up on Royal Rumble 1999, which should be a feat to talk about. Finn Martin's going to join Kenny and me for that. I'm really excited about it. You can also go to insidetheropes.co.uk/Goldust for tickets to An Evening with Goldust. Crossroads, I think, is the actual name of the show, in the beginning of March. And I think those are all the plugs. And Kenny, I think to play us out, we should play the theme music to Andrade Cien Almas so that we can hear his full name being said and weep for the loss of his nickname and his last name.
I thought for a second you were going to say, so we should play Mandy Rose's porn music to play.
I mean, we probably should, but I'm upset about the Andrade situation. No,
the Andrade situation is more pressing. And plus, Mandy Rose failed at seduction, so she doesn't get a
She did fail at seduction. She doesn't deserve to have her porn music played. She is a dastardly, dastardly human.
Although,
At least she's being treated like a heel, because if Val Venus would have done this in 1999, you know he would be the babyface.
Of course he would.
This is basically what he did with Terry and Goldust.
Very similar. I just hope... I hope he would hate... Like, if she ends up fucking the wrong Uso, I will never stop laughing. Never in my life. When, like, Jey Uso can just be like, you know... Like,
isn't Jey married too?
Ah, well, we don't know her. It's fine.
it's fine. She's off screen.
I just want to hear Jey Uso, like, talk. He never gets to talk. Just talk about the Uso Penitentiary and how Mandy Rose was in... Well, no, we can't say she's in prison, then that's right. Anyway, never mind.
But didn't she have in the note, like, I want you to lock me up in the Uso Penitentiary?
Yeah.
Wasn't that in the scandalous note?
God.
It's so cheesy. Like, it's so cheesy and crap. I almost wish they would have gone all the way. Like, I want Naomi to get amnesia and Cameron to return as Mandy Rose's long-lost half-sister who's really been in cahoots with her the whole time. And then Naomi, like, after she gets amnesia, falls in love with Sonya Deville.
I mean, I'm here for all of that. So if we can make all of that happen, I'll happily partake in all of that. Thank you very much. So thanks for listening, everybody. We hope you have a good week. We'll be back at the weekend with the Retro Raw Rundown. And to tease you, we will be back next week for the SmackDown Summary with some news about...
This is true.
Future podcasting stuff. So bear in mind to listen for that next week. And thank you for all your support, everybody. We love you lots. Here is Andrade Cien Almas for the very last time. Bye, everybody.
Not in my heart. Bye. El Ídolo!